Dr. Mark Campbell is here looking at medical myths. How often do you come across people, Mark, who believe something which is just not true?
Oh, multiple times a day. Yeah, it's happening all the time.
What sort of things do you typically have to tell people about in a given week?
Look, I mean, I think there's a lot of misunderstandings out there about a lot of chronic conditions, things like diabetes and heart failure and the best ways to manage those. So there's a lot of misunderstanding.
What do people misunderstand about diabetes, particularly if they've got diabetes?
Well, I think some people don't understand how important it is to check your blood sugars frequently just to get an idea of where things are. Every once in a while, I'll come across a patient that will say something like, oh, yeah, you know, I checked it last month and it was fine. And it just doesn't work like that.
How often should he be pricking his finger?
Depends on the person. You know, if it's somebody with really stable diet-controlled diabetes, it might be a matter of a couple of times a week, kind of checking in, seeing how things are. But somebody that's on insulin should be checking multiple times a day.
The five myths that we're going to talk about, the first one is my favorite, the 8 glasses of water/2 liters of water a day myth. Where does this come from?
I don't know. It's one that's been around a really long time. And it's hard to answer the question of how much water should you drink every day because it's different for everyone. And it turns out that our bodies are really good at keeping things in balance. So look, if you're healthy and you've got good kidneys and a pretty good heart, you can drink a large amount of water every day and your body will sort it out. If you drink too much water, well, your kidneys process it and you excrete it as urine. If you don't drink enough water, you get thirsty and you drink some water. So it's fairly simple. You know, I don't think there's any science out there to suggest that there's a magic number.
Plus, you know, it's different if you're 50 kilos or 150 kilos. It's different if it's cold or hot. It's different if you're running a marathon or sitting at home watching television.
No, absolutely. And when I worry about it, it's people that have kidney disease, people that have heart problems, because they're the ones that can't drink a large amount of water. It puts extra stress and strain on the heart, and they can really get into trouble with it. And I'm treating patients down at the hospital every single day that come in because we call it fluid overloaded.
You're listening to ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania. We're discussing medical myths with Dr. Mark Campbell. Myth number two, chocolate causes acne.
If you were to look back at the medical textbooks in the 1950s and 1960s, there would always be stuff in there about how chocolate causes acne and sweet foods make it worse. It wasn't ever really studied, though. And in 1969, there was this guy named Fulton. And he took this group of young people, they were mainly students, and he gave half of them a chocolate bar a day that had quite a bit of cocoa in it. The other half of the group got he called it a placebo bar that had just a tiny amount of chocolate in it, but tasted kind of like chocolate. Every week, these students were being assessed by a dermatologist, so by a skin doctor, and they were keeping track of how much acne there was. Several months into the experiment, he switched the groups. And so the students that were only getting the placebo bar all of a sudden were getting more chocolate and that, right? At the end of this whole thing, it went on for months and months. There was no difference in between the groups. So there was no evidence there that chocolate caused acne. And they thought, okay, the science is settled. There's been an experiment, this and that. In the last 10 years or so, there have been some questions raised about that study and the methodology behind it. You look at studies and you wonder where the funding comes from. So who do you reckon was funding Fulton back in the 1960s?
Let me guess, Nestle?
Absolutely. It was the American Chocolate Association or something like that. Yeah, you know, so yeah. It was the big conglomerate of chocolate producers in America.
I would also think that the natural testing of that, because I was surprised by the way you described it, would be a chocolate bar a day versus no chocolate bar a day.
None at all.
You know, it's not to do with the cocoa. It's to do with the amount of fat and sugar and stuff that comes with it. That's what I would think.
Yeah,
anyway.
Look, and I think there's so much that goes into it. I mean, acne, it's still pretty mysterious. I mean, my personal thoughts on it, I've read a lot about it. It probably comes more down to genetics. I mean, I think you're going to be born with a propensity for it or not. You know, probably there are hormonal effects. As you go through puberty, it's going to be worse. Yep. And then I think, too, about the products that we put on our skin, you know, makeup, lotions, things like that. And, you know, there's probably a million other things that influence whether or not you get acne, too. But chocolate, I don't know. I think the jury's still out on that one.
You're listening to ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania. We've got three more medical myths to bust. Myth number three, microwave ovens cause cancer.
This is an interesting one. I remember I grew up in the 1980s, and I remember when my dad brought home our very first microwave oven. And this thing was massive. It was big. It was loud. It rattled. It looked like something that was just very dangerous. My family was concerned about it as well. And so my dad had been a public school teacher, and he borrowed a Geiger counter from the science department where he taught. And yep. I remember one evening he comes in and he's got the Geiger counter. He's waving it around the microwave to see if there's radiation coming out. They would make us stand at least 6 feet away from the microwave when it was in operation. And look, I think what happened in the 1980s, there was a guy named Hans Hertel, and he got together with seven of his friends. They locked themselves in a room or a series of rooms for about 2 months, and they ate different foods that were cooked in different ways. So some things would be cooked on the stovetop, some things would be grilled, and some things would be microwaved. Well, at the end of this,
just come to my house. That's exactly the pattern.
Exactly. At the end of this, he held this enormous press conference. He got people from all over the world to come there because he'd done blood tests that showed that his friends that were eating primarily the microwaved food had evidence of precancerous status in their blood when he checked. And this got all kinds of press. And there was a lot of concern about, are microwaves dangerous and that. The problem is that he never really said what he was testing for in the blood. And he never released the data that he'd collected. And nobody was able to replicate this experiment. So I think a lot of the hysteria about microwave ovens came from this one incident.
It's like the 2 liters of water. Some doctor said it somewhere, and it's been repeated as a piece of folk wisdom ever since.
So that's absolutely right. And I think it's important, because you think about microwaves, it does involve radiation. There's no doubt about it.
Yep.
But there's this whole spectrum of radiation, and there's what we call ionizing radiation. That's kind of the high end of power of radiation. You think about things like gamma rays and X-rays that can clearly cause cancer.
Yep.
And they do it by knocking electrons off of atoms, and when it's going on in your DNA, there's badness that happens from that. With microwaves, though, they're not considered ionizing radiation producers. And essentially what they do is they cause water molecules to jiggle, and it's that movement of water molecules that heats things up. So really, the only danger would be if you had a microwave that had a hole in it, if it was broken, if there was something wrong with it, and somehow you're exposed to those microwaves, I think you could get a burn from it, but you really wouldn't worry about cancer.
You're listening to Joel Reinberger with Dr. Mark Campbell, looking at medical myths. Now, this is a crackerjack one. Bottled water is better for you.
I think that bottled water is one of the greatest marketing achievements of the 20th century. And I think what's happened is this. Look, before I got into medicine, I was in marketing and advertising. I worked as an account executive. And I always thought of marketing as trying to sell people things they don't really need, right? Some of my colleagues, though, were a little bit less cynical at the time, and they'd say, oh, no. It's about educating people about needs that they have that are currently unmet and then trying to meet those needs, right? So bottled water came out of all that. It was this idea that, look, there's something that you can essentially get for free out of a tap, but wouldn't it be great if we could put it in bottles, market it, and sell it? It turns out that there are three huge global companies. I won't name them, but you could probably figure out who they are. And these three global companies sell the majority of the bottled water that we drink. The problem, though, is that there's no evidence that it's more healthy for us than what comes out of the tap. Matter of fact, would it surprise you to know that over half of the bottled water that's sold actually comes out of a tap? from a community kind of supply?
I would believe that in a hot second.
And you think about it, and it goes a little bit further than that. If you're not in a place where you have to boil the water that comes out of the tap is going to be cleaner, there's going to be less bacterial contamination, there's going to be less heavy metals in the water. Part of the reason for that is that it's being checked multiple times a day, whereas the bottled water companies don't have to do that. They check once in a while, but not nearly as often as water that's being used in the community and coming out of taps. They also charge you about 1,000% more for the same amount of water. And that's not even getting into the environmental concerns, these the plastic bottles that these things come in, right? And transporting it. There's water that's sold here in Australia that comes from the United States. We're transporting this across the ocean. And you think about the fuel costs of that and everything else. It's just an environmental disaster.
What about the mineral part? Is the mineral part in mineral water worth considering?
You know, I'm struggling to think why it would be.
Are there many people who are missing the minerals that are available in mineral water? Because that's the only time it would be useful.
No, I'm going to go out on a limb and say no. You know, and it gets in, and there's this huge topic about vitamin supplements and things like that. Again, most of it's absolutely unnecessary. If you have a halfway decent, balanced diet, you get most of what you need.
Yeah, you end up with very expensive urine.
Absolutely. Absolutely, you do.
Our final medical myth to bust is, and I love this one because I've had friends who absolutely believed it. By the time you are middle-aged, you have 5 kilos of undigested meat sitting in your digestive tract. And in fact, a friend of mine who believed it showed me a photo of people who'd been on a special diet at some hippie retreat and had passed this tube of previously undigested meat.
Right.
And they're all holding up saying, look what came out of me.
Right. Okay, so I first heard this one, Joel, when I was probably about 15 years old or so. It was like the early 1990s or so in the United States. And we'd have these TV commercials there. One of the things I don't miss about the United States at all is the TV commercials. One of these things, it was for a product called, and I think it was something like Colon Blast. Right. And so the announcer gets on there.
Oh, it's horrible. I mean, did you come up with that name?
It would catch your attention, right? You'd be you know, kind of sitting there watching TV. There'd be the ad for Colon Blast coming up. But the announcer would come on. He'd say something like, by the time you're in your 30s, there are 10 pounds of undigested red meat spread across the colon walls like spackle. And it was just this very evocative thing, right? And so people would buy Colon Blast. It turns out that what was in Colon Blast and these other products like it, it's called an osmotic laxative. And so what it does, you drink it or take it, and it draws water out of your body into your guts. And so by the end of the day, if you've taken this product, yeah, it would feel like you've shed 5 kilograms of something, because you probably have, but it's mostly water. I asked one of my gastroenterologist friends about this, right? And she laughed at me. And it was just, it was a horrible moment. And she said, no, Mark, that's ridiculous. You know, there's not undigested meat just sitting in your colon.
Because, I've seen video of a probe going into somebody's back yep. passage and checking their colon, et cetera, out. I've had that done to myself.
Right.
And I've seen the video footage in there, right. And there was no meat hanging out there.
No, it should
there
be this.
There was no Macca's wrappers making
sure. No, it should be this kind of smooth, pink, kind of glistening mucosa, you know, yeah. and it should look pristine. Part of the reason that it does, though, is, and did you go through this, Joel, as part of that process where they give you the bowel prep the night before?
Yes.
And force you to drink it. Look, they've always said, and I'll ask you this because it might be a myth, they always say that the prep is worse than the actual colonoscopy itself.
Oh, yes. Okay. Oh, yes. Okay. Here comes the train. It's on its way out. Come hell or high water.
But look, there's almost certainly no evidence that you have undigested meat sitting in your colon. Most healthy people, you know, if you eat something, how long does it last in your system before you excrete it at the other end? Probably about 2 to 3 days.
Dr. Mark Campbell, you are the only guest I've ever had who would use the phrase pink glistening mucosa.
Wow. I'll take that as a badge of honor. So.
Thank you so much for being
with
us.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Busting some medical myths for us today, Dr. Mark Campbell.